The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, the simplest, most powerful website creator that helps you make headlines with your own stunning online presence. Explore elegant templates, Getty image integration, and more at squarespace.com, and use the code Guardian to get 10% off.
Nobody can give you freedom, as Malcolm X said in 1964, but can you really take it, as he suggests? This week, we're exploring how Britons submit themselves to the constraints of the workplace via a new book on the working life in the UK, All Day Long by Joanna Biggs. But first, we're examining some broader restrictions on our ability to do as we choose. According to Julian Baggini, recent developments have put us in a position to answer the problem of free will, a conundrum that has been puzzling philosophers for more than 2,000 years. But if we really can choose which football team to support or whether to eat a bacon sandwich, then what exactly is the problem with ordinary notions of freedom after all?
I think the fundamental issue is that once you started to understand the way the universe worked in a naturalistic way, that essentially we're made up of matter, whatever word you want to use, bouncing around, then there's this interesting question of how human beings might be able to act in a way which isn't simply the unfolding of nature. You know,
matter banging against matter.
Matter, exactly. You know, so I mean, you know, a flower turns towards the sun. We don't attribute any free will to it. When we turn towards the sun, we think it's a choice. But how can there be a difference when we're both basically physical things? And why does that matter? Well, it matters, I think, because of the idea that, first of all, we want to hold people responsible for their actions, and, you know, a flower isn't responsible for its actions, so if we just like flowers, that goes out the window. But also, we want to feel that, you know, somehow our actions and choices make a difference to our future, that, you know, what we think makes a difference to the world. And some people have thought that is threatened by the idea that we're all just the unfolding of nature.
Much of contemporary philosophy in Britain and the US is stuffed with symbols and equations. It's full of arcane examples designed to test how concepts perform under pressure. But that's there's not much of that in Freedom Regained. Instead of pushing your ideas to the limits to see how they break, you prefer to use examples to reveal a kind of central truth, to focus on the real world, the artist or the distant. What's wrong with the thought experiment?
Well, I mean, there's nothing wrong with the thought experiment. I like thought experiments, and I'm trained in that tradition that we're sort of semi-trashing here, so I do want to stick up for a lot of it. I think I hope to have kept some of the, if you like, conceptual rigour from that. But I think here's the real problem. Academia has become a very specialised pursuit. And what's happened is that philosophical issues, they've kind of been followed within that very narrow confines. And what happens is you've got people responding to people responding to people responding to people. It's become a technical debate within the domain of a very local manifestation of philosophy. Now, what I wanted to do with this book, I thought that actually we do kind of know all we need to know to solve the problem of free will. But, you know, in order to put it the pieces together, you've got to kind of like get rid of all that and sort of draw a new map. You've got to draw on the inside. And I do draw on a lot of stuff that comes out of that academic philosophy. It's very good stuff. But you've got to put it in a place which makes sense to our lived experience, not a place that simply makes sense to people who have a scholarly interest in pursuing that debate.
There's a moment when you suggest that the practical constraints on freedom, things like money and time and health, are so obvious that they could only be missed by those so accustomed to comfort that they take them for granted. Do you think philosophers need to get out a bit more?
Well, I think get out a bit more is a bit unfair. A lot of them do get out a fair bit, you know. I mean, you know, a lot of them are very fine people to socialise with and everything. So I don't want to knock them for that. I think the issue is more than this. Is they need to think a little bit more about why people other than themselves should care about what they're doing, make those connections. A lot of them can do it. There are plenty of people who can do it, but a lot of them, they really can't. And in a way, if they can't, fair enough, you know, each to their own, as it were, but other people have got to do the job for them. So, you know, that's why I kind of see my role, really. I don't claim to be the most original, cutting-edge philosophical mind around at the moment, but I think that I'm trying to do this job of synthesizing things and putting them together, which a lot of those people aren't doing.
So if we look at your examples of the artist and the dissident, the psychopath, the addict, what kind of notion of free will can be synthesised in the face of these results from metaphysics and neuroscience to put it under pressure?
Well, the idea of looking at sort of paradigms of freedom and its absence for me is, again, trying to sort of like drag back the debate to what really matters, try and connect it with the real experience. And I think that is actually very, very telling, because if you take notions of positive freedom, what do we take to be the real archetypes of people who display human free will in its fullest capacity? And I just focused on two, and one of them is the artist. Artists are often fated for their, you know, their freedom and their creativity, their ability to sort of defy convention and
the
so
bohemian
forth.
Lifestyle.
Yeah, the bohemian lifestyle as well sometimes, yeah, sure. And then also the political dissident, again, who is celebrated for sort of exercising their own freedom in the face of terrible oppression. And I think the point about looking at those cases is that if you think about what makes those people free, you find that it actually doesn't only not fit the sort of metaphysician's view of free will, it sometimes actually goes completely against them. So take the artist. I mean, in the case of artistic creation, how much of that is the result of a conscious process of deliberation? You know, it's a romantic view in which everything is purely spontaneous. That's clearly not true. But fundamentally, where ideas come from, etc., a lot of that the artists report, they have no idea. You know, novelists are always saying this. Any kind of interview like you hear with a novelist or something, they always say things like, you know, I don't know what my characters believe until they tell me. I'm not sure where the story is going. I was surprised when I started chapter 3 and discovered that my protagonist died. Do you know what I mean? So the idea that this is about conscious control is wrong. And that challenges a very important thing that seems to be a mainstay of the sort of metaphysical view of free will. And with the political dissident, I think it's even more striking, because, again, we think of free will as being about those things we choose. But the fundamental thing, someone who chooses to stand up against political oppression, the one thing they really don't choose at all is the beliefs and values which makes them do that. In fact, if it were a matter of pure choice, why would anyone be a dissident and put themselves up for persecution, perhaps death? What happens is the values and beliefs we most strongly feel, it's like seeing that one and one equals two. They force themselves upon us. So our choice to stand up to oppression is nothing to do with fundamentally choosing the values which we base it on. And again, that questions a whole load of stuff in traditional literature on free will, which emphasizes that point about conscious choice being the heart of it.
So if freedom is mostly bubbling up from the inside, some sort of unconscious soup, and also it reflects our capacities, our life till that point of choice, what kind of freedom is left for us?
What kind of freedom is left? Well, I think you have to get rid of some major red herrings. And I think the biggest problem we've got is that the modern notion, not contemporary, even the modern notion of free will, it's really sort of seems to assume that it's a kind of capacity we have to step outside of the laws of nature and to make a choice which is fundamentally completely unconstrained by what has gone before, our natures and so forth. Now that, I think, doesn't really make sense. And although people use contemporary neuroscience and things like this to try and challenge that view, you don't even need that. I can't even really imagine what it means to do that. I mean, I'm going to use a thought experiment now. You were saying earlier, so just to prove that I'm not totally against them. So, for instance, you know, imagine it could be the case that before coming into the world, each of us did have this kind of immaterial soul which existed in heaven. And before we were put in our body, you know, St. Peter said to us, what kind of person do you want to become? And we could choose that. That is the closest we could get in a thought experiment to having ultimate responsibility for who you become. But if you think about it, that makes absolutely no sense. Unless you already have some values on which to make that choice, you can't make the choice. It's like flipping a coin. So there's a kind of impossible version of free will, which is about being entirely responsible for what you do, which is a load of old rubbish. And the sensible view of free will is the one we recognise just in ordinary life, which is that we do actually know that people can, to a greater or lesser extent, control their own actions, take responsibility for them, change what they do in the future, respond to reasons, pressure, and so forth. And so free will has to be this much more modest thing, which is no more than the capacity to build our own powers of self-regulation.
For will self, one of the things that makes a fictional character moving is the obvious lack of free will. As we read a novel, we're swept away with Anna Karenina falling in love, even though we understand intellectually that she's in some sense already thrown herself under the train, even before we put the novel off the shelf. There's a similar kind of shift of perspective at the heart of our worries about free will. If Laplace's demon can already read our fates in the Book of the Universe, then in our sense of freedom just as illusory as Anna's?
Well, not quite. I mean, you know, the Laplace thing doesn't really stand up quite as much. I mean, because, you know...
Because it's impossible.
Well, because it's impossible, because, you know, the universe doesn't quite unfold with quite that sort of billiard ball type way. There's unpredictability, but unpredictability doesn't really help with free will. If things occur because of completely deterministic laws of nature or random laws of nature, it's still just laws of nature. But the idea that, in some sense, if someone could see into the future, if someone could turn to the last chapter of Story of Our Lives, they'd see what would happen. That means that there can be no free choice. I think that's just a kind of a mistake. I mean, you can see in terms of God, a lot of people thought that if you believe in God, and God is omniscient, and God therefore knows what you're going to do tomorrow, that just obviously means you have no free will. But, I mean, I don't think that's true at all, and Augustine didn't think it was true. God being able to see what you will do tomorrow can simply mean that. God knows what you will freely choose to do tomorrow. So I'm not convinced that the mere fact that we can imagine certain perspectives from which everything seems inevitable. I mean, to give a little mundane example, if you live with someone or you're very close to someone and you know them very well, often you know exactly what they're going to do next. Does that mean it's not a free choice? I mean, that's not a conclusion we draw, is it? It's rather we know what they're going to freely choose because we know what they're like. And there should be no threat from the idea that what we choose to do freely flows from relatively stable dispositions, preferences and values. In fact, we want that. Someone who we had no idea what they were going to do next because they had no stable character or so forth would not be a model of freedom and responsibility. They'd be a model of just, you know, psychological chaos.
That's no good, is it? I'm just wondering where the metaphor breaks down. Because, I mean, if we're looking at Anna Karenina on the shelf and she's all done, so we know what's going to happen, so we don't think she's really free, how's that different from, as it were, stepping outside the universe and looking at all those people in the universe and seeing that these things happen to them and then they're not really free either? Where's the problem?
Well, the metaphor doesn't really work in the same way, because in the novel, the character is entirely written by someone. There's intention there. Now, in order to get that metaphor across to human life, you can't just say it's written. That's the idea of like fate or predestination. That's not the same as a kind of scientific determinism. You'd rather have to say that the equivalent is that just as Anna Karenina is just playing out the role set for her by the author, then we are just playing out a role which is somehow just determined by what's going on in at the atomic level. But I think the problem with that is, it doesn't really quite make sense for various reasons. I mean, scientifically, it's not obvious it makes sense. I mean, you don't have to be anti-science here. I mean, I think most people would now conclude that there's a very common view now that at different sort of levels of organisation, physical matter takes on characteristics which cannot be entirely predicted from those at the very bottom. So, for example, if you want to explain why the lion is jumping at the antelope, it's no good looking at the subatomic level, right? You have to look at perceptions of the lion, the biology of it. You have to look at the biological level. In the same way, I think it's totally appropriate to say that to understand why humans do what they do, you have to bring in the psychological level. And the idea that everything is best explained or ultimately explained by what's going on at the lowest level in nature, it's a form of reductionism which, I mean, it still has its advocates, but from my understanding of it, I mean, even in mainstream science, that's not certainly an uncontentious view anymore.
Certainly not, no. You were arguing before that the issue of free will is important because of the implications of kind of justice and self-respect. But if freedom really is a capacity which can be exercised more or less fully, then the answer to the problem of free will has implications that go all the way from the personal right up to the kind of political, to the way we organise society.
Well, yeah, they do, I think, you know. And I think it's very interesting in a sort of a political sphere, for example, you tend to hear kind of two extreme views, not so much by the parties, but there's this tendency to kind of say, look, social conditions have nothing to do with why people are criminals and everything. It's a slur on the poor to say it's their poverty which leads them to crime. We all have this absolute free will and we can do what we choose, right? Well, that kind of flies in the face of evidence that, in fact, your life circumstances make a huge difference. You know, anyone who's worked with violent offenders knows that almost invariably those people were victims of violence themselves. With sexual abuse, it's even stronger link. On the other hand, you go the other way and you just say, oh, well, you know, people, they're just a victim of their circumstances. There's nothing they can do about it. That's kind of patronising as well, because people don't think that about themselves. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, the truth is somewhere in the middle, which is that everyone is a product of their circumstances, for sure. And we're severely constrained. And sometimes, you know, things work out for people such that they are kind of doomed. They are like those tragic people in the novels. They were always going to end up dead young or in prison, whatever it might be. But I think the goal of politics and social life is to try and grant to people the tools and the ability so that they're not just simply fated to do that, that they can learn to take control of their lives, and they're given the capacity, economic, educationally as well, to control their lives. So I think it's actually a very important political point. And in fact, you know, when people talk about political freedom, they tend to talk about the negative and positive freedom, as though these things are kind of to be seen as two different things you have to kind of balance out. So on the one hand, there's the freedom of non-interference to just get on with your life. On the other hand, there's the freedom to be able to pursue your goals, which might require, you know, you being given education, healthcare, and so forth. And I think rather than looking at that kind of dichotomously, I think what we're trying to do is enable people to maximise their capacity for self-regulation, self-control, direct their own futures. And that requires us to, on different occasions, sometimes leave them alone in order to get them to take responsibility and so forth. But it also requires us sometimes to sort of level out the unfairness of pure luck and social injustice and give them the tools. So, you know, this way of looking at things unifies those political senses of freedom, I think, a little bit more.
Guardian listeners get the latest news, but they can also create it. With our sponsor Squarespace, you can easily create an elegant website for your personal brand, online store, business, personal portfolio, or blog. Whoever you are, Squarespace's simple tools and elegant designs make your ideas newsworthy and accessible to any audience. Try it at squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
Julian Baggini, and Freedom Regained is published by Granta. If philosophers should get out more, as Baggini, well, almost suggests, then they're sure to find themselves somewhere alongside the potters, fishmongers, advertising executives and baristas Joanna Biggs encounters in her study of working Britain. Here's hoping they don't find themselves sitting next to T, the 32-year-old call centre advisor Biggs talked to in Lincoln. He always wanted to be a bin man, he explains, but somehow has spent the last 11 years hunched in his ergonomic chair, listening to customers complain about their broadband. When Biggs came into the studio, she began with a brief account of T's working day.
He gets up at 6 a.m. most days and walks the 2.5 miles to work listening to music. The music is to stop me thinking about the fact that I'm heading here. His MP3 player is broken, so he has been borrowing his wife's. He cannot skip quickly enough when it gets to Balamos by Enrique Iglesias. When he gets to work, the first thing he'll do is have a cigarette outside. You find out what's going on here 2 months before the management do. He must be logged in and ready to take calls at 8 a.m. Somewhere between 9:15 and 10:45 a.m, he'll have a break for 15 minutes. A coffee in the canteen is 90p, but T brings milk from home and makes his own. He used to have a coffee every hour, because it was an excuse to get away from my desk. Now he has cut down to 3 or 4 a day. As he works, sitting in an ergonomic mesh chair in his headset, he'll be reminded by large electronic screens on the wall striped green, amber or red how well he and his colleagues are doing in responding and handling calls. The standards change, but they create both time and emotional pressure. T is supposed to answer and deal with whatever arises after a call is finished in a certain time. He has to direct the problem to the person who can solve it on the first call. He must collect details like mobile numbers, email addresses and assent to a text message customer satisfaction survey. You have customers who don't want to listen, but you've got managers breathing down your neck, saying you've got to let them speak to you like crap, basically. A notice board at the entrance divides ordinary phrases into two columns. I'm not sure, usually, obviously, and maybe, are below the line and ought to be avoided. Above-the-line terms include lovely, excellent, and what can I do? The emotional labour of a call centre isn't just learning to withstand a customer's impatience, but also learning to speak in a voice other than your own. At lunch, he'll smoke, or he'll call his wife, his kids, or his grandparents. There's someone to ring every day. Everyone who works there gets free broadband, and there are landlines provided in the atrium, under nursery bright murals of slogans like, "Let's pull together, we're one big team," and "We don't shift the blame," and "Do something brilliant." In the yellow-walled staff canteen, most sit alone, eating in front of a propped-up tablet computer or hunched over a smartphone. The next break is around 2 p.m. If there's a particularly nasty call, he'll go out and smoke, hoping someone will be out there. That's really the only way to survive it when you're getting calls like that. You need to vent about them. If you get stuck on a call at 4 p.m, you can't tell the customer, and managers don't always notice the ends of shifts. T doesn't feel satisfied at close of day. You've got no vision of what will happen to a call once you put the phone down. It goes off somewhere else. Someone else deals with it. And whether they get things right, get things wrong, get it fixed, you don't know. At the end of the day, T will walk home again, or maybe stop for a drink with a colleague. I couldn't tell you the amount of people I've been friends with, gone out drinking with and whatever, and I never see now because they don't work here. 30 years ago, and 70 miles west of here, the pottery glazer Alan Goldsmith's work and life were happily interwoven on the Wedgwood estate. Here, work actively diminishes T's life. The next morning, as T gets ready for work again, his young son might tell him, "No, Daddy, no work. Work's closed. No, work's closed."
So why write a portrait of working Britain? Why now?
I think this sort of thing should be done maybe every year, every 5 years, actually. I mean, the sort of books that this sort of book is were much more popular in the 70s. When I started thinking about it, I was reading a lot of Studs Terkel. It's a great book by Barbara Garson called All the Live Long Day. And these things was exactly the idea of just going out and talking to people, finding out what's going on with them and putting it down.
And is the attraction of this kind of project is a kind of middle ground between sort of statistics, surveys and kind of quickfire media stereotypes and kind of biography and memoir on the other hand, find a sort of space in the middle.
Yeah, which is maybe an odd space. I tried to think of it as a portrait because very much how I did it was I would find someone, talk to them and sort of hope that talking to them, everything would come out of the conversation. So I had a set of questions that I would ask, some of them the same every day. What did you want to be when you were a little girl or boy? Do you think you earn enough? That was one question I asked everybody. Things like that, and just trying to open up a conversation, seeing what came out of that.
It's very much based in your observations as well of their immediate work environment and kind of the way they are as they are answering your questions.
Yeah, some of it, I thought quite hard about that because obviously with the way Studs Terkel did it was they just spoke to somebody and wrote it down and then reshaped whatever they had into a sort of monologue, like a dramatic monologue. I just felt there was so much you missed if you didn't do that. And when I spent a day with a fishmonger and seeing him interact with customers, seeing how he laid out the fish, like the way he picked up a hake, you know, they do it by the tail, not by the head, you know. And all those things I found really interesting, and I thought it's such a shame for the reader not to get to see those. I get to see them, but they never get to see them, you know. I'd love to know what Studs Terkel, what he thought of the people he met and the environment he met them in. Occasionally he does add it in like kind of little asides, like a kind of dramatic aside in a play, but yeah, I feel like the reader misses quite a lot by not getting that.
You divide Britain at Work into different sections. There's selling, which has got your fishmonger, advertising executive, legal aid lawyer, and entertaining has got a footballer and a dancer and so on. How would you compare the experiences of the people working in these different sectors?
Well, some of them are extremely different. I mean, the straightforward selling, obviously a fishmonger, you know, he wraps up a fish in paper for you, you pay him, it's fairly straightforward. And obviously legal aid lawyer, that's something slightly different, what is going on there. I wanted to make people think about how these skills are actually used in their own lives in ways, so that things that you think you don't do, you actually do. The lawyer, he doesn't sell, you know, in fact in the Magna Carta you're not supposed to sell justice, but what he's doing is persuading you in a certain way, and in fact he does have to, with the appalling changes to legal aid, he does have to sell the idea that it's okay for someone who's done something wrong to have a lawyer paid by the state for the sake of, you know, equality of arms and things.
But it seemed to me that, very much broadly speaking, those making and thinking were happier and more fulfilled than those caring and serving.
Yeah, and I think that's definitely one thing that I noticed throughout writing the book, that these jobs that were made traditional, straightforwardly understandable, and straightforwardly productive as well, obviously making and these things, you can see what you've done at the end of the day. That's
an obvious output.
Yeah, exactly. Whereas these caring and serving jobs, this movement towards emotional labour, this idea that you sell your time and your emotions and you smile for money and you talk about how much you love your job and you email at weekends and all these things that have started to become the emotional investment we have in our jobs, that's as sort of making becomes more automated, this is the area that opens up for humans to work better. And I find that quite scary, talking to some people about how much they love their jobs and how much emotion they put into their jobs sometimes.
It's got huge implications for life in the UK. I mean, as you say, it's really shifting. And now you've got 80% of UK workers and 92% of women workers employed in the service sector, compared to just only 10% in manufacturing and 7% in construction. Not to mention all those people who are caring for children and or relatives outside the kind of waged economy. So basically, most of us are doing that kind of job.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And I think that's where the most interesting resistance to work is happening too. I include in my book a stay-at-home mother because I do feel that is work in the same way. Not every job in the book is a waged job that you might expect. And one particular person I really enjoyed speaking to on this was a sex worker. The sex worker was in traffic. She's part of an English collective of prostitutes. She wants to be doing the work she's doing. She sees it as work, as not as, you know, something she's been forced into. But she had really wise things to say about, obviously she's using her emotions all the time. These men turn up and she has to calm them down and get them in a state, you know. And I think she was very good at knowing that she was playing a role at certain times. At the end of the day, she would just put everything aside and, you know, have separate, a kind of, her work life was kind of enclosed. And that resistance to kind of work seeping into every aspect of your life, I think, is a good thing to do.
But that's something that, as the machines take over, the kind of grunt work of manufacturing, that's something that more and more of us are going to have to struggle with.
I think so, yeah. But I think she's got exactly the lessons. We should be listening to people like her who've been doing it for a long time and know how to resist these things, yeah.
I was wondering about the interview with the sex worker, actually, in particular, because I was wondering if there are dangers in focusing on, like, for example, your Pret employee, who was a guy who was fired after getting involved in union-related activity, or indeed your sex worker, who you say enjoys her job and is actually sometimes even disappointed when her clients finish early and she hasn't yet reached an orgasm.
Yeah.
Are there dangers in focusing on these as kind of representatives of their chosen professions or their areas?
Oh yeah, of course they are. I think that's why I tried to call it a portrait as opposed to anything else, because I think I would have found it very difficult to I don't feel I've represented the whole country. It's this snapshot that reflects things that I think are going on in the workplace. I'm not sure what an entirely representative book would look like. Maybe someone could commission me to interview everyone in the country. And then I could
take a long time.
Yeah. But then it would be truly representative.
But I'm wondering if when you were looking for your interviewees, were you looking for stories that were kind of vibrant and colourful, or were you looking for people who would kind of represent what was going on in a kind of more broad sense?
I guess a bit of both. It happened actually quite organically. There were always people I knew I wanted to speak to, and I always knew I wanted to hang out with a rabbi for a while and see how his life was. And I knew I wanted to hang out with cleaners. I knew I wanted a mother to be in there. But then also things kind of came out organically. So when I started working on the chapter about making, I didn't think initially I'd have a robot. And I thought, no, that's the only... They are the workers. They are doing most of the making. So I knew I had to go into a car factory and see how these enormous robot arms worked. And so it sort of happened naturally like that.
But, I mean, as this organic process evolves,
yeah.
you, I guess, make connections and meet other people that you wouldn't have necessarily thought of in the first place.
Yeah.
But when you sit down at the end of the book, I mean, you say you discarded quite a number of interviews in the making of it. When you sit down at the end, if the sex worker you select is someone who enjoys her job, that gives a really odd picture of sex work in the UK.
Yeah, I see what you mean. I did think about that. Well, I feel like one of the things about using my voice as well as their voice in some of these sections is being able to give historical context, but also being able to say it's different for someone who's been trafficked, which I do say in that chapter. And of course, no one person can be representative of an entire profession. And I think also she's got lots of valid and interesting things to say. And I don't think because she's happy in how she organises her work that there aren't other people who aren't happy in where their work is organised. It's just a problem of representation, I suppose. And all I felt that I could do is speak to them honestly and present what they said to me as honestly as possible. One could write a book for each of these professions, along with the book that interviews everyone across the country. I mean, you know, there are always just limits on what's possible.
Plenty of work to be getting on with, then.
Yeah, exactly.
Some of your interviewees, of course, like your sex worker, are finding enjoyment and fulfilment, whereas others are longing for the freedom to do something else. I'm wondering if after doing this project for the last few years, whether you think that work in Britain is basically something that mostly enables us to maximise our potential or just nothing more but chains.
Well, just one thing I found constantly interesting was the discussion I'd have with people about money. So I'd say, do you think you earn enough? That was the way I would approach it. Sometimes I would say, well, how much do you earn an hour? Usually to people who aren't earning very much, because people who are earning a lot don't like answering that question and would avoid it in interesting ways. But one thing I find extraordinary about that is that everyone said that money didn't matter so much. And they might have been lying. They might have been saying what one feels you ought to say. But actually, I think work gives us more than that. That was why the project interested me, because I remember first coming to London and getting my first job and just being sharing a flat with two other girls. And just in the evenings, we would just discuss work. It was just sort of this fascinating, weird, alien world that we'd never really been let into before. You know, we were all literature students. All our novels were about, you know, how to fall in love and all that sort of stuff. We had no idea how this... So we'd talk about everything, like the kind of who makes the coffee, how the coffee does, what people wear, where people sat, what people went for lunch, what our bosses were like, how do we deal with our bosses? All these kind of... There's a lot of investment of who we are and what we do in what we do all day. And also, when you ask somebody, you know, what do you do, why do you do it? You're asking them, you spend your whole life in this place doing this... Who are you? What are you doing? Why are you doing this? So you often end up having these conversations about their whole lives and what their lives mean to them, which were amazing conversations to have with people.
Did writing this book make you feel differently about your own work?
It did, yeah. It did. I mean, it made me appreciate... I work for this magazine called London Review of Books, which is an incredible place to work. I have such interesting colleagues, and we create a magazine that I'm very proud of. But at the same time, I would think I would... You know, I'd be very inspired by some of the people who resist against work. So the prep worker you spoke about, he formed a union when he wasn't supposed to form a union and he got fired for it. And they should have a union at prep. Those people should have a union. Similarly, the cleaners at the University of London has formed a union themselves and campaigned for sick pay as a holiday and pensions and got it. And that was very inspiring to me. So I did sort of think I'm very lucky in my work, but it's always good to have more resistance and anger against some of the things that aren't so good in everyone's work, even in a job like mine that's, you know, wonderful. That's one thing I thought about more and more, yeah.
So the LRB look out.
Not quite.
Can such a literary book really change the world? Can it make us free from the drudgery of bullshit jobs?
I'd love it if it could. And I've had that experience of reading myself, and I mean, not this book, but other books you read, and it does make you think completely differently about your life and think how you might rearrange things. That's always the hope, right? In writing a book, that someone somewhere might think that.
Joanna Biggs. All Day Long is published by Serpent's Tale. To while away the hours until the revolution comes, you can find more literary discussion on iTunes, SoundCloud, or on the Guardian Books website. Just search for Guardian Books Podcast. Thanks to Joanna Biggs and Julian Bagini. From me, Claire Armistead, Richard Lee, and our producer, Eva Krishak, goodbye and see you next week.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.